Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
We've known for a long time that genetics does play quite a substantial role in depression risk, but what we've also known is that depression looks very different from one person to another.
A new research found out why women get depressed more than men. We have all the details. Also, a new company is supporting veterans in becoming financially sustainable. And later today...
So once Science and Nature was selected, we brainstorm with our landscape architects to think of how can we tell that story of science and nature in garden bed designs.
The Floriade in Canberra is about to close, and this year's theme showcases science and nature. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a research project is exploring new avenues to better protect vulnerable seasonal workers across regional Australia. Many regional seasonal workers experience strict visa conditions, low pay, and housing unavailability, which often leads to them living in unsafe and poor quality housing conditions. Industries such as agriculture and hospitality are highly reliant on seasonal workers to fill shortages. I spoke with senior lecturer from Monash University's School of Social Sciences, Dr. Sarah Niner, who was a part of the research team, to learn more.
The three major categories we looked at were the working holiday makers. So they're from a range of different countries. Traditionally, it's been Europeans coming out here, young Europeans coming out on holiday. They get to stay for a year. And then if they want to stay for longer, for another year, they've got to do 88 days work. So about 3 months work in particular industries in rural areas. So they've often gone to these sort of tourist sites, they've worked in hospitality, but also in harvesting in the agricultural sector, fruit picking. And they sort of see it slightly as slave labour too. Mm. They're tied to these visa conditions if they want to get to stay in Australia for another year. So that's the one major group. The second major group are the seasonal worker programs. So they come in for season, harvest season, to pick our fruit and vegetables. And they're here from kind of 6 to 9 months, and then they go back. And then there's this group that come for longer periods that I looked at that are working in meatworks particularly, abattoirs and meat processing plants, and they get to stay for 4 or 5 years. And they're often these palms workers. So this is our Pacific Island Mobility Labour Scheme, and it's workers from the Pacific in Timor-Leste, and they do this seasonal work or they do the meat work. But it's being extended all the time now to aged care, to hospitality, to the sorts of industries in Australia where we have quite big labour gaps.
Could you describe, like, what's some of the worst living conditions that you've heard from, like, from your colleagues or in your particular areas of the seasonal workers?
So it's the sort of temporariness of the accommodation. So they've been labour hire firms and employers have taken over caravan parks and motels and things, and they're squashing as many workers in as they can. So a caravan that was designed to probably fit a small family, like a parent and a couple of little kids, is now housing 3 to 4 workers. So you've got adults sleeping in kids-sized bunk beds and sharing a space together that's designed for people to have a 2-week holiday in, but they're living in them for sometimes years. And what might have cost a $200 or $300 a week caravan, they're charging per head the workers a couple of $100 a week, so they're making $800 a week on that caravan. So the big issues are cost, overcrowding, lack of privacy, and that gets worse when you're a long-time worker. It's something to put up with something for a few months, but different to have to put up with it for a few years. So it's the temporariness of the accommodation, which means often the heating and cooling is pretty bad. There's no substantial infrastructure to it. There's not enough storage. So I had one guy tell me that they lay out all their clothes on the bed and sleep on it because there's no storage for their clothes or anything else. So the kind of bad quality accommodation, the overcrowding within that accommodation, and then these rates they're charging them for this low quality accommodation. So they're the three main sort of complaints about the accommodation.
Could you go into detail into what recommendations or reforms should be implemented to help resolve this issue, if it can be resolved in the future sometime? Like, what does the research findings come down to?
One of the first priority findings we had was that the visa settings need to be adjusted so that people aren't tied to one employer. They can move around. But if they're being exploited in the job or the conditions aren't good enough, or in the employer-provided accommodation, if that's awful, then they can look for another job and move on to somewhere where the workplace environment's good and the accommodation's better. So tying people to one employment, we're creating the conditions for exploitation and bad conditions. Then our research focused on accommodation. So we need to look at new ways of providing better quality accommodation, and that really needs investment by the government or some kind of private public initiatives where we're building housing. We're going back to building housing for key workers, which the government used to do many years ago. As a matter of course, they built teacher housing, they built railway worker housing, they built immigrant housing, and we haven't done that for so long now in this country that there's a crisis. So there's all those sorts of things that need to be changed. But also what we found when we were talking to workers is they don't know what the accommodation standards are. And in fact, in the regulations surrounding all these schemes, there are quite good housing regulations. They have to have a certain amount of space, there has to be a certain amount of bathrooms and laundries and kitchens per number of workers. But because the workers are never told what these conditions are, and that they don't know how to complain or there's no one to complain to, because the government has provided very poor complaint systems and they haven't told the workers in their own languages how they can complain safely without losing their job. But all these systems need to be fixed. One of the union reports in this area describes the people that are supposed to be going out and ensuring the companies and the labour hire firms are adhering to the regulations. There's so few inspectors for the 400 employers in the PALM scheme, but there's no way the regulations, they're not enforced in any rigorous way by the government. So people are getting away with all sorts of things. So another of our recommendations is that workers need to be informed of their, not just their workers' rights, but their housing rights as well, and that there are systems of complaint that are adequate.
That was Dr. Sarah Niner, Senior Lecturer from Monash University, ending the report. A new international study led by a research team at QMIR Berghofer, Queensland, has identified biological and genetic differences which may explain this gap. The research, the largest of its kind, analysed data from over 400,000 people worldwide, including a significant Australian cohort. It revealed women and men may experience different biological pathways to depression and discovered 6,000 different DNA changes that could cause depression in females only. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with Senior Research Officer Dr. Brittany Mitchell, co-lead author of the study.
Our group's really interested in depression and the role that genetics plays in depression risk, and we've known for a long time that genetics does play quite a substantial role in depression risk. But what we've also known is that depression looks very different from one person to another, and one of those big differences are what depression looks like between men and women. This is in all aspects, but one of the most common ones or most prevalent ones is the prevalence. So we know that women are about twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression in their lifetime, and that's quite a big difference. And so what we were really interested to do is combine our interest in genetics and see if genetics is part of this reason on why women are diagnosed at a lot higher rate than men.
As you have touched on there, how does your study investigate the way in which we understand the differences in the female experience and the ways they express depression compared to men?
I think one of the important things around the study is that we did just focus on the genetic aspect, and we're by no means saying that genetics is everything. And we know that many things plays a role, environment, different life experiences. What we were able to show in the study is that genetics or people's biology also contribute to these differences.
How could these sex-specific insights inform the way in which mental health services or prevention programs to be designed for women or for high-risk groups more broadly?
You know, I think what we've shown is that just that they experience different types of depression. And this is really important when we come to treatment. You know, depression treatment really is lagging behind other medical conditions, and there's a lot of reasons for this. But we're still in this kind of one-size-fits-all and trial-and-error basis where, you know, you try one medication, see if it works. After a while, if it's not working, they'll put you on something else. And then, you know, if we've got these different biological differences and these different pathways that are happening in the brain, we could potentially use this to personalize medication better and make sure that people are getting the more effective medication sooner. And with that, sex is a really important part, and to perhaps men and women need to be treated differently.
With this being an international study, does the data tell us anything different about the Australian populace comparative to other countries?
Not specifically, but we are really excited and really proud of the Australian contribution. We've got an amazing big cohort that was collected. It was based here in Brisbane, called the Australian Genetics of Depression Study. And it was through this cohort that we were able to lead the study. And so we're really proud of being able to lead from Australia on a worldwide stage, and the contribution that Australians have made by volunteering both their time to do the questionnaire and their saliva samples that we're able to get DNA from. And this is really just the start. We've got so many more interesting questions to look at that would be more Australian specific. So now we know about the DNA changes, but there's a lot of environment and differences in that we can start to look at how that interacts with the DNA.
With all this in mind, what are the next steps for this research? For example, potentially looking at intersex individuals or multicultural and ethnic influences, and how can collaboration with communities help guide future studies and interventions?
We've been very careful in the study. You know, when we try to talk about it, we talk specifically about sex and not about gender. And that's, you know, gender is a very big term, and it can mean a lot of different things. And there are many, you know, different types of genders. And so we're just looking at what we'd call chromosomal sex, or sex inferred by chromosomes. But that doesn't accurately represent everyone, right? And so we've got a lot more to do around that, as well as looking at the role of gender and not chromosomal sex. And then other ancestries is a huge priority for us, and that's something that we really need to do. The data is really lacking in that. Most of the data we have are from people of European ancestry, and it's just not good enough. Like, if you want to get to the point where we're personalizing medicine and getting new medications, we want that to be representative of everyone. So our future work's really to try and incorporate and expand who we're looking at.
Dr. Brittany Mitchell from QIMR Berghofer there, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Canberra on 2XX FM, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. A new organisation is helping and supporting veterans to become financially stable after their service in the Australian Defence Force. National Service Financial was founded by Wayne Bemmett, who served 20 years at the ADF and experienced financial challenges after being medically discharged. Veterans face several challenges once they finish their service, and the transition to a civilian life can be complex. The Wise Eduardo Jordan started asking Wayne Bemmett to explain more about the aims of his company.
So, yeah, it was an idea I had for a company whilst I was in service. was fortunate enough to serve 20 years serving my country, which was amazing. But one thing I did notice whilst in service is that I didn't think people were necessarily making the best use of their time financially. So, you know, it's all well and good to, you know, represent your country at the highest level, which I'm extremely privileged to have done that on multiple occasions. But when it boils down to it, you've got to have more than just a chest full of medals when your time ends. So, you know, paying attention to your finances, you know, taking steps to get a roof over your head. And there was certainly a big gap around that. You know, there were some people that certainly got it and have done well, but the majority were just lacking the tools, I think. And that's certainly something I picked up on whilst in service and certainly when I discharged as well. So, you know, National Service Financial was, again, based on a lot of my personal experience as well, particularly when I medically discharged back in 2017. It was a tough period, but we had to scramble quite hard for information and to make sure, you know, me and my family were going to be looked after life after service. So it was about finding information and finding it in a timely manner to make sure that we were going to be looked after and the family was going to be secure. It was a tough, really tough experience. So that's really the genesis of around what I've put together is, you know, helping people not only through that transition experience, but also, you know, making sure they're making the most of their time in service financially as well, mate.
What are the main challenges veterans face after their service and why is it such a big problem?
Yeah, oh, I think that's a great question, mate. And everyone's transition experience is different, but we've helped over 2,000 veterans, and the common theme that we are seeing is that there's a distinct lack of, you know, access to quality information. So, you know, that's what we pride ourselves on, is being able to find information for people in a timely manner so they can complete their transition. So that's just one aspect, but another major aspect is certainly that loss of identity as well. So not even talking about the financial perspective or the ones and zeros, there's certainly a change in identity, or certainly a loss of identity. And that's certainly what was my experience back in 2017. You know, I went from I started out as a seaman radar plotter on warships and worked my way up into aircrew whilst I was still in Navy, but working with the RAF. And, you know, I really worked hard and felt like I was having a fantastic career, but then injuries can happen quite quickly. And it certainly did to me. And that's quite common for people throughout the ADF.
And what are some of the benefits retired members from the ADF can obtain from the federal government that will help them to be financially sustainable in the future?
Yeah, so yeah, this is the one of the things we're quite big on is, you know, showing people where to look. So from the first perspective, you know, Australian military people do have quite a good superannuation fund, both with ADF Super and MSBS. So if they're medically discharged and they can release their super on medical grounds, we do help people do that. But also when they receive compensation from the Department of Veteran Affairs, they will receive money for funding for financial advice. And that's essentially our business model, Eduardo, is that we prefer to, you know, fund the veterans' financial advice through money that's allocated from DVA. So it's around about $3,200 at the moment. But also the Defence Force Transition Program also offers every single person who leaves the ADF $1,000. So, you know, we think that's more than enough for us to do what we need to do. And we're very strong with, you know, the veteran not having to put their hand in their pocket if they don't need to.
Now, besides getting these benefits, what other things can veterans do to make it easier to be financially sustainable after, you know, ending their service?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, when I first started the company, Eduardo, it was certainly around helping people at the back end of their career if they've been medically discharged or got compensation from injuries, you know, that they get looked after quite well and deservedly so. But what we're trying to do, Eduardo, is talk to more people who are actually in service now. So, you know, if they're paying attention to their finances whilst they're serving, look, I understand better than most that can be challenging because the job that's people do in serving our country, it's you're so immersed in it that sometimes your finances kind of get a little bit neglected. So our sort of mission is to help people financially succeed and make the most of their time in service, not only professionally but also personally and financially. So when it comes time to, you know, transition to be a civilian and I guess what I call the real world, is that they've actually got, you know, their finances behind them, they know what situation financially they're walking into, and they're actually quite well prepared. So that's our mission. I guess this company was born out of my personal experience and the struggle, and I guess, you know, I was thinking at the time, you know, I can't be the only person going through this, so I took it upon myself to put up my hand and help others.
That was founder of National Service Financial, Wayne Bemmett, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. This weekend, Australia's biggest spring celebration is wrapping up in Canberra. Floriade is the biggest gardening event, and this year's theme is science and nature, bringing to life the most recognised scientific fields of physics, chemistry, astronomy, biology, and botany. To find out more about the event, the WISE contributor from 1RPH, Janelle Provost, spoke to main gardener at Floriade, Tim Howard.
With the once the theme is selected, so once science and nature was selected, we brainstorm with our landscape architects to think of how can we tell that story of science and nature in garden bed designs. So we've come up with 12 unique garden bed designs. Some of them include an atom, DNA strands, we've got a light prism, think maybe like Pink Floyd, and the splitting of light through a light prism and refracting. And really it's playing with colors and proportionality and viewpoints to create visual interest for our visitors, and to really display the tulips and all of our other flower varieties the best way we possibly can.
How long did it take you to actually come up with the designs?
It's probably a process of maybe across 8 weeks. We try and do a couple of beds each week and then really fine tune them. This project, because it's 18 months long, it's full of milestones. So we need to get the designs done so we can order all the flowers. We have to order all the bulbs. We have to make sure all the colors are correct. We've got the right quantities to fill out the colors to make the pictures. So it's quite complicated and it's a little bit stressful, I'll tell you.
And the last few days with the rain, did that send you greyer?
I welcomed it actually, because it's cooled things down, which means our flowers last longer. I checked the rain gauge. We took 45 mils of rain in 24 hours on site on Wednesday, a few days ago. And the grounds have held up really well, and the flowers certainly appreciated. And rain, of course, has dissolved nitrogen in it, so it makes everything greener. So as a gardener, I welcome the rain.
And that was going to be my next question about how you actually keep flowers blooming for a whole month.
Yeah, that's it. The pressure to keep 4 weeks of flowers in bloom is on. And the way we manage that is a very careful approach with the flower varieties we use. We use early, mid and late blooming variety bulbs, and we underplant all of the bulbs with annuals. So using that two-stage planting process and using mid, late and early flowering varieties, it means we're guaranteed to have flowers for the whole 4 weeks. And regardless if we have a late winter or an early winter or a late spring or an early spring, we've straddled those key dates that we need to cover for.
The last event of Floriade is the big bulb day, the big bulb dig day. Why do you do that? Because wouldn't it be better just to keep these bulbs for next year?
Well, one of the key things about a Floriade is that we've got brand new designs every single year. Now, the logistics of extracting each of those bulbs and sorting them back out into their colours is just an impossible feat. Also, when the show closes mid-October, the life cycle of a tulip, they're not ready to finish their growth cycle yet. So they need to stay in leaf and keep growing for another month or two. And what they're doing then is they're growing next year's flower and storing that energy, and they want to die down naturally. So based on when Floriade closes, it's not very compatible for us to try and retain the bulbs that we use. So the next best thing we can do is give them back to Canberrans and the public and raise money for charity. And that was the driver behind doing the bulb dig.
That was Tim Howard from Floriade speaking of 1RPH's Janelle Provost. The event concludes on the 12th of October, and the Great Big Bulb Dig is on Monday, 13th of October at the Commonwealth Park. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.com. www.wyacknowledges.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluwik. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.